Welcome to PCMC. I'm Mike Bendrono, and I'm here today with nobody. Yeah, I'm all alone today. Wait, don't turn this off. There's a reason why I'm alone. It's not because everyone has abandoned me. That hasn't happened yet. I wanted to talk just me today because today's topic is Ghostbusters Afterlife. And if you know anything about the show, you know that Ghostbusters is near and dear to me. Ghostbusters is my urtext. It is the earliest fandom I was ever a part of. Along with Star Wars, it's probably one of the two biggest pop culture influences on my life. Except with Star Wars, I remember when I saw Star Wars. I was a little kid and I didn't understand it. And then I watched it on my own when I was 12 and my life changed. But I can't really tell you how I got into Ghostbusters. I do remember watching Ghostbusters, the original movie from 1984, for the very first time. I've told this story on the show before. My grandmother sat me down in a Big Bird plastic chair. I was directly in front of the TV because it was the 80s and people didn't understand that that was not healthy. And when the library ghost jumps in that first scene, I fell out of my Big Bird chair and ran away and cried and said, that's not Ghostbusters. But the reason I was excited to watch Ghostbusters was I was already into the cartoon. I didn't even know there was a movie. My grandmother, who was babysitting me and probably looking for any reason to distract me from climbing up the walls, said, hey, you want to watch Ghostbusters? She had the VHS of the movie. And I was like, there's a movie? Because even as a baby, little nerdy me knew that movies were cool. But how did I get into the cartoon? I have no idea. Ghostbusters is like, it's like, how did you meet your siblings? I don't know. They were always there. Ghostbusters, the cartoon, the real Ghostbusters, was on Saturday mornings and on every day after school. There were actually two different seasons going. I didn't know this at the time. I know this now. There were two different kind of productions or seasons going on at the same time. There was the every day after school, what they call strips, after comic strips. And then there was the Saturday morning, which were basically, I mean, for all intents and purposes, the same show, but they were on different networks and they kind of followed their own track, their own continuity. I don't know if continuity is the right word because a Saturday morning kids show doesn't really have, you know, a seasonal arc the way that TV shows now do. You know, every episode is just a new ghost shows up, there's some problems, the Ghostbusters show up and fix it. But anyway, Ghostbusters was just always around, and the Ghostbusters toys were always around. They were a big part of my life. The Ghostbusters toys were technically from the real Ghostbusters cartoon, yet they didn't really correspond that well to the cartoon. The actual figures of the Ghostbusters looked like their cartoon counterpart. A lot of the ghosts that were featured on the show never became toys, or maybe none of them did, and a lot of the toys never were featured on the show. It was almost like its own entity. They would just make these really creative ghost toys that were usually based on some kind of pun, like Bug Eye, who is a very famous toy. He's a big purple monster and he's got a big eye in his forehead, and when you would hit him, the eye would pop out. He appears in a fabulous cameo in Ghostbusters Afterlife. So Ghostbusters is a huge part of my DNA. When I think about Ghostbusters, probably the first thing I think about was New Year's Eve 1989. I was at a relative's house, and the two cousins that I grew up with, they had their proton packs, and I had my proton pack. There was an agreement then, in the 80s, when we were all kids, that your kid always had to have his proton pack with him, because when the three of us were together, we were going to play Ghostbusters. That's just how it was. My proton pack was literally my proton pack. And I think getting to Ghostbusters Afterlife, the idea of a little kid having a proton pack was, to Jason Reitman, the co-writer and director of Ghostbusters Afterlife, the sort of germ of where the film comes from. He says that he had a vision of a little girl in a field with a proton pack, and he didn't know what to do with it. And then when Harold Ramis passed away, he said, oh, I've got it now. She'll be related to Egon. So I'm going to put this episode together in a handy-dandy numbered list, because the internet loves numbered lists. And I'll even tell you up front what our chapters will be. Part 1 will be my feelings and reactions towards the film Ghostbusters Afterlife. Part 2 will be me reacting to some of the criticisms of the film that I'm hearing and reading. Part 3 will be a list of the things that I loved about the film. Part 4 will be my nitpicks and the stuff I didn't like, which isn't that much, because I'll tell you right now, I love this film. And 5, where I want this franchise to go. Now, let me say up front, huge, huge spoilers. It's all a big spoiler. This episode should be listened to either after you've seen Ghostbusters Afterlife, or if you have zero concern about the movie and you don't really give a crap at all. Because I'm going to talk about every aspect of this film, top to bottom. So, I've seen the film 3 times now. It only came out last week, but I saw it the day it came out. I saw it the preview on a Wednesday. Then I saw it again Thursday on my own. And then I saw it Friday with Jen in a drive-in, which was pretty awesome. I'll be honest, the first time I saw it, I wasn't sure if I liked it. A couple things were going on. Number one, I was having a really crappy day. Actually, 2 things were happening. I was having a crappy day at work, and then I was having some other financial troubles, and I was just anxious and just felt tired and shitty. And seeing it was similar to seeing a new Star Wars movie. Now, this is something I'm used to with Star Wars. I know that when I see a new Star Wars movie, I can't even tell you how I feel about it after I've seen it the first time. Watching a new Star Wars movie is like being a new mother and letting somebody hold your baby for the first time. I make this analogy not being a parent, but I feel like it's apt. I just sort of watch with a cringe in my face going, please, please don't drop my baby. Please don't fuck this up. I have to see it that first time just to know that nothing egregious has happened. For instance, when I saw The Last Jedi, the first time I saw it, like a lot of people, I was disappointed that Luke wasn't being the Luke I wanted him to be, that it just wasn't the movie that I wanted it to be. It wasn't until I saw it again that I realized how brilliant it is. Now, when I saw Rise of Skywalker, I kind of knew right there in the first viewing, this sucks, because they dropped my baby. J.J. Abrams dropped my baby. Halfway through Rise of Skywalker, I was like, oh, this is bad. So, which I could kind of actually relax after that and enjoy the badness of it. So when I first saw Ghostbusters Afterlife, I was kind of like, huh, I don't know how I feel. Well, I can tell you one of my main feelings was, damn, they gave everything away in the marketing. So many things in this film that would have been completely amazing and delightful had I not known they were coming, I was just simply sitting there waiting for. The mini puffs, which are these little Baby Yoda-esque, although they may have been conceived before Baby Yoda, these little Baby Yoda-esque Stay Puft Marshmallow Men, but they're tiny. And they come in herds. They're like little gremlins, but even smaller. They're like the size of Smurfs or something. If I had not seen them in the ad campaign and I just saw them in the film, I would have laughed hysterically and been delighted. The scene where the main character Phoebe is in the Ecto-1 and she sees that there's a gunner seat that comes out of the side of the Ecto-1 and you could shoot from the gunner seat. That is a reference to the cartoon where there was a gunner seat on the roof and of the toy. This movie does a cool thing of referencing the toys. I would have flipped the table. I would have jumped out of my seat if I had seen that in the theater, but I knew it was coming. I can't entirely fault the film because this film was done and ready to be released before the COVID-19 pandemic began. But then, of course, it happened and Sony did not want to release this film digitally, did not want to release it via streaming. They said, this movie is a theatrical release. It's going to be a theatrical release. So it was pushed and pushed and pushed. You could tell that because there's a kid cast, and when you see the kids now in interviews, they look more grown up. You know, kids grow fast. The main character, Phoebe, who's played by McKenna Grace, when you see her in interviews now, she's a teenager. But in the movie, she's basically a baby. So this movie's been on a shelf for a while, and I think Sony thought, well, how do we keep people excited for this movie? We can't just keep jerking them along. We got to give them something. So I think because of that, they released clips, and they released images, and they released trailers, and a lot of the big surprises were given away. I mean, honestly, the whole film was given away. Seeing all the trailers and watching all the clips, you can piece together exactly what the film is and how it will end. And I kind of did. And that sucks. I have friends that don't watch trailers, and my hat tips to them because I do not have that fortitude. I am a nerd, and if you're going to give me a little crumb, I'm going to eat it up and be excited about it all day. I don't have the strength to not watch a trailer for a movie I'm excited about. So I put myself in this situation. The second time I saw it, I saw it alone. The first time I saw it with Jen. It was a big deal. She loved it. We had a great time. There were little kids there, which was exciting. The theater was not full, I have to say, other than going to see King Kong, but that was in a small theater. Kong vs. Godzilla. I have not been in like a packed theater since the pandemic started. Although at this point, Ghostbusters made about $60 million this weekend, both internationally and in America. So it was slated to make around $35. So it's made more than they thought it was. So it's considered a success. Although it made less than what Ghostbusters 2016 made, interestingly. So the second time I saw it alone. I was just like, let me just go and see it. I don't know how I feel about this movie, you know, and I'm not going to lie to myself, right? I'll never go through Star Wars Episode 2 again. I'll never convince myself I like something that I don't. So I went. And having seen it the first time and just like being able to like relax and just chill out and not worry that it's going to drop my baby, I found it so much more delightful. Everything clicked. Everything worked for me. And I was like, you know, this is a great movie. And it also is working on a level of, it's almost not a Ghostbusters movie. It's a Ghostbusters inspired 80s kid adventure movie. I mean, if it's like an 80s movie, it's not like Ghostbusters. It's like Goonies. It's like E.T. It's like Monster Squad, which is not a very good movie, but you know, you get my drift. Then the third time I saw it at a drive-in, again with Jen. It was her second time. And it was a ball. I love it. I at that point, I had favorite parts that I was like excited for, favorite quotes. I could say genuinely that I love this movie now. I don't think it's faultless or perfect. You know, it is a movie genetically designed to be exactly for me. So, of course I like it. But from the audiences I've seen, I think kids like it too. So I do think it is a good start for where this franchise can go. Basically, I love this movie. Unabashed love. If I had to rank the Ghostbusters movies, it would be Ghostbusters as number one. Ghostbusters Afterlife is number two, the second best. Ghostbusters 2 as number three. And coming in fourth, Ghostbusters 2016. Or what's actually called Ghostbusters Answer the Call. I don't hate that film, by the way. I have talked about this a lot on the show, so I don't want to repeat myself. I think it had a lot of potential that it didn't fulfill, but it's not a terrible film. It's an okay comedy. I guess that ranking isn't very exciting. The only news from that is that I do think Afterlife is better than Part 2. I would watch Ghostbusters Afterlife more than I would watch Ghostbusters 2. Okay, Section 2. Ah, I love that sound. Reactions to criticisms. So, one of the criticisms is, this is just an unoriginal reboot. This is just more of what Hollywood does. They just rehash what we've already had. They just take our childhood and repackage it and resell it to us. It's completely unoriginal. Well, original is a concept that's only a few centuries old. You know, the idea of original, something new, is honestly naive. There's only so many stories to tell. Everything builds from something else. That's how culture works. Culture builds on itself. Quite recently, the YouTube channel Storied, which has a really great series called It's Lit, these fun videos about literature, did a whole episode on this. And they talked about Shakespeare, how everything Shakespeare wrote was based on something else. Obviously, his histories were inspired by real figures. But Romeo and Juliet was based on an earlier poem. Hamlet was based on a earlier story. Everything was based on something else. And at the time, nobody said, oh, that's Shakespeare. He's so unoriginal. Oh, he's copying people. Those insults, copying, unoriginal, those are very new. Those are new concepts. You know, music, art, all of that stuff builds off of the past. If you want to get a better idea of this, there's a couple things you can look at. One is a documentary film called Rip, a Remix Manifesto. That's a really great film that focuses on the work of the mashup artist Girl Talk, but with a larger context talking about copyright law and how copyright law in the United States has introduced capitalism into the soul of art. And this is why we have these ideas of originality. Another thing to watch is a very famous early internet essay before video essays became all the rage. There was Everything is a Remix, which comes in 3 or 4 parts. You might have seen this at some point in your life or like clips of it. Very famous. You could find it. Everything is a Remix kind of makes a similar point. It draws a lot on examples from Star Wars. There's one episode that's all about Star Wars and where Star Wars got everything from Joseph Campbell's theoretical influence to the influence of Flash Gordon movies and Akira Kurosawa samurai films. Everything comes from something else. That's just how it is. And you know, I don't think the film has ever claimed that it's original. Originality is one of these things that people think is the goal. You know, it's one of these preset things like, oh, is it original or not? Well, maybe the goal isn't original. How about that? Why should original be the goal? There's nothing original under the sun. If you think there's something original, then you just don't know enough. Ghostbusters itself was inspired by earlier sort of ghost comedies like Abbott and Costello's Hold That Ghost. I find that argument, not just with this film, but in general, to be a little bit hollow. Do I think that there are too many remakes and reboots and now cinematic universe? Yes. And the reason is because the way it should work is you should be able to take an earlier text and reconfigure it and readapt it in whatever way that you want. But now because of the prevalence of copyright law and intellectual property being property, you can't do that. I can't go and sort of make my own riff of a Batman movie. I either have to make it a straight up parody of a Batman movie, or I have to pay Warner Brothers and just make it a Batman movie. You know, I think the prevalence of IP in our current pop culture, it doesn't point to unoriginality in part of the artist. What it points to is we're kind of in a chokehold by a legal system that's gotten its hands on our ideas. The public domain is where ideas are supposed to live after a while, but copyright law keeps being changed to protect large corporations. This is why Mickey Mouse is not public domain, although he should be. Look at characters that are public domain, like Dracula, Frankenstein, Sherlock Holmes is a public domain character. Look at all they've done with Sherlock Holmes. They've remade him and reconfigured him. There was, of the last, you know, 15 years, American movies that were kind of steampunky. There was 2 different book series that were based on a female descendant. Basically the same idea. One was Enola Holmes, which became a Netflix show with Millie Bobby Brown. And then the other was Charlotte Holmes. There was the BBC version with Benedict Cumberbatch. There was an American TV version. House, the show with Hugh Laurie, the medical mystery drama, is highly inspired by Sherlock Holmes. Okay, next criticism. It's too indebted to the original film. Well, it's not shy about that fact. It takes its model actually from The Force Awakens. It's not a film exactly like The Force Awakens, but Jason Reitman, the director of the film, has said that The Force Awakens became his sort of model of how to make the film. And by that it means have new characters, but have the new characters live in a world where the original story exists. The original story is now a myth. In Ghostbusters Afterlife, the characters talk about the events of New York, the ghost stories of New York, the Marshmallow Man, and did it really happen, or, you know, all of these things. Similar to the way in The Force Awakens, Luke Skywalker has become a myth. Is he real or is he not? You have characters that are grounded in a world similar to our world because the story, the narrative of the original film that we love is both a part of our lives and their lives. It's a kind of way of being meta without being annoyingly so, without, You know, without it being a world where the Ghostbusters movie exists. You know, people hate that. Like, look at the new Bewitched, where Bewitched was a show and then they were remaking it, and then but she really is a witch. People hate that shit. That the new Doogie Howser does the same thing. She's a young doctor and they just start calling her Doogie as a reference to Doogie Howser. But in fact, the show is called Doogie Howser and it's a remake. So it's like, that's annoying. So the movie unabashedly is indebted to the original. And that, as a criticism though, I think has limits because it actually draws a lot on these other 80s movies. It's not a remake of Ghostbusters. Doesn't take place in a city. It's not like the 2016 film that rebooted the original story. This is a movie about kids in a small rural town, dirt roads and farms. And, you know, they move into a haunted house that's haunted by their grandfather's ghost, who's a benevolent ghost. And they find these Ghostbusters items and they learn about the Ghostbusters. And it's, in some ways, it reminded me of the movie Fright Night. You know, if anything, I actually think that when you look at it visually and narratively, Ghostbusters Afterlife owes more to E.T. than it does Ghostbusters. I mean, it's E.T. It looks like E.T. There are shots that I think are right out of E.T. Even the end where we see Egon's ghost and they all say goodbye to it. That's like the end of E.T. Egon is the E.T. of Ghostbusters Afterlife. By the way, on that level, the film really, really works. I really loved especially the second time I saw it. I found myself loving the cornfields and the old roller skate diner and just that world. I really found myself really digging that. It's a kid's film. You know, how could you say it's too indebted to the original Ghostbusters when the Ghostbusters was this comedy and this new one is a kid's film? Okay, next criticism. Why is this film so reverent? Ghostbusters is just a dumb 80s comedy where one of the Ghostbusters gets a blowjob from a ghost. Why are you putting this prestige on it? Well, here's the thing. Ghostbusters Afterlife is brilliant in that it reacts to what Ghostbusters is rather than what Ghostbusters originally intended to be. Yes, Ghostbusters was a fun, zany, urban comedy. And it totally succeeds on that level. It works as that. But from the moment it hit theaters, kids loved it. It became an animated series, yes, but it's not like it became popular with kids because of the animated series. Kids loved the movie. You know, they did something very rare, which is they made a family film without knowing they made a family film. Children just loved it. And they didn't think that children were gonna love it. They didn't realize what they had there was something that was gonna be special to kids. So now, 30 years later, Afterlife grounds its film in that idea. It's a story about outcast kids who are living in a scary, uncertain life, and they find something to give them strength. See, my belief, being a little kid is scary. You're scared of the dark, you're scared of outside, you're scared of strangers, you're scared of what's under your bed. You have a nightmare and you're scared. And the thing about Ghostbusters is it's scary, but the grown-ups laugh at the scary thing. Bill Murray makes fun of the scary thing, and that gives little kids confidence. When I was a little kid, when I was wearing my proton pack, I felt invincible. I felt like I have some power. And I think that is why children like Ghostbusters. See, the 2016 film is a more faithful remake. It reboots the idea of a zany urban comedy. But this film, Ghostbusters Afterlife, it doesn't think about what was Ghostbusters intending to be. It thinks about what is Ghostbusters now. Like, what place did Ghostbusters find itself in our culture? It became a classic for children. And by the way, when we were kids, we didn't know we didn't understand the blowjob joke. It went right over our heads, okay? We just saw funny, silly guys fighting scary things, and we absolutely loved it. So this film reacts to that. Okay, next criticism. It's weird that the film ends with a CGI ghost of Harold Ramis. I don't know how they did it. They did it like probably they did Governor Tarkin in Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. It's CGI. And it doesn't look too bad because he's supposed to be a ghost. So you can put on top of the CGI Egon, nice blue force ghost sheen on him, make him look kind of transparent. You get away with a lot. A lot of people are saying, is this tasteless? Is this ghoulish? Is this a bad way to end your film? I understand that. And if you did feel turned off by that, I don't fault you. I understand. Here's the argument. When it comes to matters like this, the question is consent. It's a question of consent. It's digital consent. What will you digitally do with my body? I own my body. And obviously Harold Ramis died in 2014. He can't give his consent. Well, his family gave his consent. And his family also read scripts along the way. Jason Reitman went out of his way to try to make his family feel like they were part of the process. That's number one. Number two, and again, this is speculation, but I truly believe it. Harold Ramis would be totally cool with it. Harold Ramis, look, he's not Dan Aykroyd, right? Dan Aykroyd invented the idea of Ghostbusters, and he believes in ghosts, and he rants and raves about ghosts all the time. But second to Dan Aykroyd, Harold Ramis was Mr. Ghostbusters. He co-wrote the first two films. He took Dan Aykroyd's original script, which was a science fiction comedy in the future where Ghostbusters were an actual occupation that many people had. And he said, okay, let's bring this idea down to earth. And he helped shape it into the Ghostbusters that you know. He wrote Ghostbusters 2 with Dan Aykroyd. Over the last 30 years, he wrote many versions of Ghostbusters 3. He was dedicated to making a new Ghostbusters. Coincidentally, he wrote a script of Ghostbusters very much like this script in that it had one of the Ghostbusters appearing as a ghost. Because the reason Ghostbusters 3 never happened was that on the film Groundhog's Day, which starred Bill Murray but was directed by Harold Ramis, they had a huge falling out. They were having artistic differences in what the story should be. That movie, the whole set was a mess. The fact that it's a classic movie that's great is sort of mind-blowing because it's a fucking mess. Bill Murray was just rewriting his own shit all the time. But anyway, Bill Murray started to be an asshole, so he started coming in late. He started slowing down production. At what point, Harold Ramis actually, like, pinned him against the wall, like, threatening to beat the shit out of him. And from that point on, they finished the movie through an intermediary. They weren't even talking to each other. Ramis would have to give his direction to, I think, the AD, and the AD would have to then talk to Bill Murray. And after that, the idea of them making a Ghostbusters was very, very unlikely. So, whenever they would ask Bill Murray about Ghostbusters, it would be Dan Aykroyd who would ask him. In a sort of flippant, I don't want to do it way, he would always just sort of glibly say, I don't want to be in it the whole way. Look, I'll do it if I'm dead and you just make me. I'll appear in one scene as a ghost. I'll do a cameo as a ghost. Well, even though he kind of didn't really mean that, he just said it as a fuck you, they wrote it. Harold Ramis wrote that version. So I don't think Harold Ramis right now would see a version of Ghostbusters where one of the Ghostbusters is a ghost and not like it, because he worked on a script very similar to that. Let me make an aside about Bill Murray. I love Bill Murray. I think he's a comedic or an artistic genius. There are two Bill Murrays. There's the Bill Murray that shows up at your wedding and crashes and gets in all your pictures and becomes lovely. There's the Bill Murray that shows up in construction sites and reads poetry. There's that crazy Bill Murray that we hear about that's just like, he just goes around being delightful. And then there's the other Bill Murray. There's the Bill Murray who got into a fight with Lucy Liu and basically picked on her during Charlie's Angels, which got him kicked out and he wasn't part of Charlie's Angels too. There's the Bill Murray that abused and actually threw a glass ashtray at Richard Dreyfuss on the set of What About Bob? You know, to his credit, a lot of the him being an asshole stories seem to be older. He seems to be cooler now. But Bill Murray is clearly, I think, a genius. McKenna Grace, the star of this film, in an interview said, at the end of the film when the Ghostbusters show up, she was very confused because she had the director, Jason Reitman, directing her. But then the producer of the film was Ivan Reitman, who's Jason Reitman's father, and he's the director of the original films. And then Ivan would give her a direction, and then Bill Murray would give her a direction. And she was like, I don't know who to listen to. I respect all these people. He did make up with Harold Ramis. When he learned Harold Ramis was really sick and going to pass away, went to his house. He didn't know where he lived, so he went to the local police in where he lived and said, hi, I'm looking for Harold Ramis's house. Can you bring me there? And they brought him there. And Harold Ramis was on his deathbed, but he apologized, and they laughed, and they cried, and they made up, and, you know, it's a beautiful thing. And you might remember that the year Harold Ramis died, Bill Murray did something really awesome at the Oscars. He was, I think, him and Amy Adams were presenting the Oscar for Best Director, and they read the nominees, but then on his own, without telling anybody, just improvised it. He said, oh, one more director, Harold Ramis for Meatballs, Ghostbusters, and Groundhog's Day, and everyone went crazy and applauded Harold Ramis's career. So, anyway, on to part three. Stuff I Loved. Mom. Carrie Coons plays the mom, and she's like, she's totally an 80s kid movie mom. She's talks, straight with the kids and makes jokes with the kids, but she's, you know, struggling. She's on her own. She reminds me a lot, again, of the mom from E.T. She's also very funny. She's a very real character. I mean, they make McKenna Grace, Egon's granddaughter, like a little Egon. She's a little nerd. She has Egon's glasses. She's got Egon's hair. But Carrie Coons is very much just, you know, a character. She's just a kind of realistic, quotes, person living, kind of being broke and not having a husband around and just trying to raise these two kids and really having no support. They don't explain what happened to her mother, but my guess would be that her mother passed away. That's a little unclear. But I love her. She's really, really great in the movie. She's funny. She's fantastic. Okay. Probably the thing I like most in the movie is McKenna Grace as Phoebe. I think this kid is going to be huge, huge star. She's already done a ton of stuff. She's on Handmaid's Tale. Not since, like, I guess, Abigail Breslin when she first came out and everyone was like, whoa, this kid is incredible. She's incredible. She's really adorable in this. She's really funny. She's the heart of the movie. I think if she did not give a good performance, the film really wouldn't work. But she does. She's a perfect little Egon. She's cute. There's a running gag where she is, you know, she doesn't have any friends, so she's trying to make friends. And so she learns, like, bad dad jokes, but she doesn't understand even what makes them funny. So she delivers them all really brilliantly. And of course, as a young actress, she has a musical career. So in the credits, she has a song called Haunted House. Podcast is the second kind of kid. He's kind of the Ray character in this movie. And he's played by Logan Kim, who this was his first movie. He's another brilliant kid. The casting in this movie is amazing. This kid is so funny and so charming. He's going to be a lot of people's favorite character. And I think he's actually the funniest character. I think a lot of the laughs come from Logan Kim. And, you know, when I first heard there was going to be a character named Podcast, who called himself Podcast, and because he had a podcast, I was like, okay, is this going to be a character who has, like, one thing? But really, the podcast thing is, he makes a podcast based on supernatural stuff, because he's, like, a big conspiracy kid. So he's basically, like, the Ray of the original Ghostbusters. But it's really just a device to keep him, you know, he's isolated. He doesn't have friends either. So it's a sweet story about, you know, outcast kids. And he becomes friends with Phoebe, and it's really adorable, and he's really funny. I think people can really love Logan Kim. What else do I love? Okay, this is just like a small thing. In this film, they do this thing where the ghost can touch the proton beam. So the proton beam is always worked as like a lasso. And in this film, twice you see the ghost actually grab the proton beam. And well, one character, Muncher, actually bites it and then releases itself. And then the other character, which is, this is the end, Gozer, who's the villain of the original film and is back for this. You know, in the original film, they cross the streams to defeat Gozer. In this film, they try it, and she actually takes them in her hand and uncrosses them. That's just a cool little, I think, update. That's a cool little thing that you could do now with our technology that you wouldn't have been able to do in the 80s. Also in this film, speaking about Gozer, I love something they did, which was, if you remember the original film, there was the terror dogs. One was the gatekeeper, one was the keymaster. And, you know, one was possessed Rick Moranis, and one possessed Sigourney Weaver. And these two had to come together and mate to kind of give birth to Gozer. In this film, they use a ghost trap to trap one of the terror dogs. And what that does is it kind of rips Gozer in half. It kind of makes a half Gozer. And it's not like half, like literally like half down the middle or half, you know, at the torso. It's like you see her skin evaporate and then you see like her musculature, but then you see some of her veins. It's literally like she half is existing. And they use that to sort of kind of make a trap for her. They take the terror dog in a trap knowing that Gozer will follow. Or this sort of half Gozer specter. It's really cool. Another thing I love is the house. The house was actually built. They built it twice. One on the real set, in the real location, I should say. And one in a soundstage with green screen. And you just have to look it up. It's a perfect haunted house. I mean, right there, it shows you the tone of it as like a kid's spooky movie, because it's such a cool looking haunted house. I mean, it's not realistic, and I mean that in the best freaking way. It's got such a cool haunted mansion-y look to it. I mean, it's not ornate like Haunted Mansion. It's supposed to be like a crappy farmhouse, but it's got like this blackness to it. It's really, really cool. And this film, in a way, is a reconstruction of a haunted house story. You know, kids move into a haunted house, but it's a good ghost. It's the ghost of Grandpa helping you. Okay, this is really in the weeds, nerdy for Ghostbusters fans, but I'm, you know, that's what PCMC is all about. Okay, so in the end, the original Ghostbusters show up, and Bill Murray does this thing where he is making fun of Gozer. He's talking to Gozer like they were a couple, then they broke up, and she's crawling back to him. He's just doing his Bill Murray thing where he's sassing the ghost. They cross the streams, Gozer uncrosses them, knocks them down on the ground. All the Ghostbusters are down on the ground, as they often end up. Gozer is approaching them, and as she's approaching, Bill Murray is saying, you know, you and me, we could have been such a power couple. You with your good looks and me with my stunning personality. But oh, you always had to maim. You always had to murder. And while he's doing that, Winston is getting his proton beam aimed at her and tries to shoot her. And then Gozer shoots the proton pack and it doesn't work. And Bill Murray goes, oh, well, that was a nice try anyway. Okay, why I love that little moment, besides the fact that it's funny, is that it makes explicit something that Ghostbusters fans have always known, which is Peter Venkman has a method. He verbally rope-a-dopes the ghost. He's almost like Doctor Who. He just talks nonsense at it, confusing it and befuddling it until he creates a moment where they can attack it. And I mean, I guess that was always obvious, but I kind of like that this little moment makes it really explicit. The moment where Phoebe calls Ray and lets Ray know that Egon passed away, and you see Dan Aykroyd, who I think does a really good job in this movie. He's a better actor than people remember. Remember My Girl? Come on, guys. Remember My Girl? He does a great job. You see his heartbreak when she tells him Egon died, and it's that got me misty-eyed. Not the first time. The first time I was a cranky bitch, but the second time. And the third time, that's the scene that really gets me misty-eyed. So the last thing on my list of things I love are Phoebe's bad jokes and her adorable delivery of them. In the end, when Gozer first appears, she tries to distract Gozer, kind of like Peter Venkman would, but she's not funny. So she tells these jokes, a bunch of them, and Gozer just sort of like doesn't know what she's doing. And she has a really funny delivery. She tells the grasshopper joke. Grasshopper walks into a bar, and the bartender says, hey, we have a drink named after you. And the grasshopper says, you've got a drink named Steve? And she delivers it with everything, and it's really cute. It's really funny. Okay, section 4. Oh, I guess the sound's not gonna... Okay, section 4, nitpicks. So I basically love this movie. So some of these may be annoyingly petty. Why are the mini puffs there? It doesn't make sense. In the original film, when the containment unit is breached, there are ghosts everywhere, and you've got a montage of just spooks and specters everywhere all over the city. But in this film, something like that doesn't happen until the end. And when, Paul Rudd, the sexiest man alive, he's possessed. Him and the mother, like Sigourney Weaver, they're the ones who are possessed by the terror dogs. And before that, they kind of go on a date and stuff. Which is better, because the original movie, Rick Moranis had a crush on her, but she didn't like him, so it made the consent weird. So he goes into a Walmart, and he sees the mini puffs, and then he's approached by the terror dog and chased down and attacked and gets possessed. But that kind of breaks the rules. Why are the mini puffs there? First of all, why are they puffs like this? What does it really have to do with the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man? It's cute and adorable, and you could easily probably just pass it off as, well, there's spooky things about because Gozer's coming back, but it doesn't really make sense. What are the rules of Gozer? Because I thought Gozer couldn't just kill. I thought you had to choose the destroyer. Wasn't the whole point of the original Stay Puft Marshmallow Man that she gives you the option to choose your destroyer, and Ray thinks of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man and that comes to kill her? That doesn't happen in this. In this, Gozer just tries to zap you Emperor Palpatine style. Also, and this is less of a nitpick and probably more of a real criticism, why did it have to be Gozer? Come up with something new. To give credit to Ghostbusters Answer the Call, at least they had an original idea. They didn't do Gozer again, or Viggo again. I understand why they did it. Again, it's very Force Awakens to just kind of redo the same thing. And it gives a reason to bring the Ghostbusters back in a more organic way, the original Ghostbusters. But I don't know. It could have not been Gozer. By the way, in this film, Gozer is played by Olivia Wilde, which is an interesting cameo. There's a couple of interesting cameos. Olivia Wilde is Gozer. J.K. Simmons plays Evo Shandor, who, if you recognize the name, he was the person who constructed Sigourney Weaver's apartment building in the original movie. He was the Gozer worshiper. He's been alive all this time in sort of this weird stasis, but he's kind of underused. He's there for a second, And he's like, it's that thing where he's like, Gozer, I have worked my whole life to bring you back, and together we could rule the world. And then she just immediately murders him. And it's like, oh, okay, well, that was J.K. Simmons. And then Muncher, who's kind of the Slimer of this film, is voiced. He doesn't speak, but he's voiced by Josh Gad. Okay, so another nitpick is the film is kind of this idea that Egon went crazy. You know, in the beginning, they say Egon went crazy. He abandoned his wife and child. He abandoned the Ghostbusters. He went to live on this farm and nobody knew what he was doing. And what we're supposed to learn in the end was that he knew that Gozer was going to come back here. And he was there as the sort of sentry. He was standing there guard of our world. There's a cool thing where he has this setup where Gozer is. The spirits all coming out of this hole in the ground, and he has set up this apparatus that's a PKE meter that's set to 4 proton packs. So when the PKE meter detects ghosts, the packs go on, streams cross, and then that goes into the hole. It's sort of a stopgap. You know, it doesn't permanently stop the problem, but it keeps putting Gozer at bay. And that's what all the earthquakes are that you see in the trailers. So anyway, what we learn in the end is, oh, Egon was a good guy all along. He wasn't a bad guy. He was trying to save the world. You know, your dad wasn't bad for abandoning you. That doesn't completely track, because, like, he couldn't just explain to the other Ghostbusters calmly, like, what he thought was going on. Ray says that he just disappeared one day and took all the traps and took all of their equipment and didn't talk to them for years and years and years. He left his wife and daughter. He just left them. And even when you go into Egon's house, it looks like a mad person's house. So, I don't know. The film, I think, is unclear itself on what it's trying to say there. Is Egon crazy? Is he crazy but right? Was he not crazy at all? It's not totally clear. Speaking of Egon as a ghost, I have no problem with him being a ghost. Like I said before, I think it's a matter of consent. But he stays a little too long because he doesn't speak. You know, he shows up at the end and it's like, okay, cool. But then he kind of like has a goodbye moment with everybody. He's just there a little too long. You know, something like that is a little bit goes a long way. And I think he's there just a little too long. Also, their old Egon is based on, like, if you took Egon from the original film and aged him up, he wasn't fat. They punked out. They wimped out. They're cowards. Harold Ramis was fat. Everybody knows Harold Ramis became fat at the end of his life. They should have made Egon fat. I was very upset by this. Another nitpick. They only play the Ray Parker Jr. song at the very end. For a movie that's so indebted to the Ghostbusters, I mean, what are you trying to be classy? Play it more, for Christ's sakes. Why are you going to make me wait till the whole end to play it? Play it in the middle somewhere. Let's see. Oh, one of the things that I probably hate the most is the mini puff scene. And it's not because of the mini puffs. It's because it's filmed in a Walmart. And it's all about Walmart product placement or product integration and Baskin-Robbins product integration. And I'm not totally against product integration. I mean, I am, but I accept it. But look, Walmarts are so ugly. I mean, really, if you've ever been in a Walmart, they're just ugly. They're some of the most ugly public spaces we have in this country. And it's an otherwise beautiful, bucolic film that then has this one scene in an overlit, you know, white plastic. Ugh. It's just an ugly, ugly scene. I hate it. It just looks so bad. It's just, they look so bad. If you've never been to Walmart, go. They're ugly. Another nitpick, or maybe a more real criticism. We don't know too much about the two older Ghostbusters. So there's sort of a new team in this movie. Even though they're not, they don't go into business. They're kids that try to solve the problem. At some point, they have to save the day. So they put on their own costumes and they try to stop Gozer before the real Ghostbusters show up and kind of save them. So you've got Phoebe and Podcast are the two younger, and they're kind of the Egon and the Ray. But then the two older characters are Phoebe's older brother Trevor, played by Finn Wolfhard from Stranger Things, and Lucky, played by Celeste O'Connor. And look, they do a good job, but you don't know very much about Lucky and Trevor. Trevor likes cars, and he kind of rebuilds the Ecto-1, even though he doesn't have a license. He failed his driver's test, so whatever. Lucky, you know very little about. She's just a love interest, and Lucky's African-American, so sadly, once again, we have a Ghostbusters team where the least developed one is the African-American one, which really is a bummer. Trevor is kind of like the Winston, because he's the one that everything has to be explained to, and Lucky's sort of the Peter, because she's cool. If there's one thing I guess you get from Lucky in the few scenes she's in, is that she's cool. She has a cool hero moment at the end where she busts out of the house with a proton pack. It's not like, you know, the kids don't do anything. The kids basically save the day, but then they trip at the end and the original Ghostbusters are there to help them. Another nitpick, Muncher just happened to be exactly in the same place that Phoebe was when she was trying her proton pack. Paul Rudd says earlier in the movie that it's been 30 years since there's been a ghost sighting, so that's just a little too, I don't know, maybe is there some connection there that I'm missing? It just feels like, well, this is very easy that she's trying this proton pack, and oh boy, now she's got a chance to catch a ghost. What perfect timing. And this is my last nitpick, and I don't fault the movie for this. This is just me. This is all me. I kind of wish Slimer was in it. Slimer isn't in it. He could have been in it. I guess it's restraint on the part of the filmmakers to not put Slimer in it. But, you know, I would have liked to have seen it. It's a nitpick. Chapter 5, Where I Want to See the Franchise Go. Jason Raymond has said, without saying the word cinematic universe, he has basically said he wants a Ghostbusters cinematic universe. And it's been clear, actually since 2016, that that's what Sony wants. This film does something interesting where, in filling the gap of where the Ghostbusters have been in the last 30 years, Winston has gone into business, into finance, whatever that means, and he's become like a millionaire. Winston is crazy rich now. And at the end, we see Winston reopen the firehouse. He doesn't reopen the business, but he literally opens the firehouse and he brings in the Ecto-1. He takes it from the kids and he's going to restore it. And there's a post-credit scene where he's talking to Janine and he says, you know, I may be a businessman, but I've always been a Ghostbuster. You get the idea that how the franchise could go forward is Winston is going to finance Ghostbusters, maybe all over the world, maybe in every different city. Jason Reitman has said that he would love to see all these different versions of Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters all over the world, Ghostbuster teams that look like everything you can imagine. And I think that's cool. This movie made a good amount of money, and I think there will be a sequel to this film. By the way, I would love for there to be a sequel to the 2016 film. I think a sequel probably would have been better because a lot of the bugs would have been worked out. I know this will never, ever, ever happen, but I would have loved to have seen that. I think more the merrier. I think you could. I think look, we talk a lot about these cinematic universes. Marvel does it the best. Star Wars is kind of struggling with it. The way to do it is you need diversity. So if you want a Ghostbusters cinematic universe, let Afterlife be The Force Awakens. And now let's move on. Now let's just do more movies with the kids, do movies other places, go ahead and do Dan Aykroyd's original idea. Let's see Ghostbusters in the future. Let's go wild. Let's do a bunch of different things. There was an idea around 2016, actually, of doing an animated film about the original team where they would just come back and do the voices. Not Harold Ramis, but everyone else. Fucking do that. That'd be awesome. Look, I think there'll be a sequel to this movie. I hope there is. I want to see more Phoebe and her friends. I just want to see more. I want there to be more toys. I just want more. And I hope this film opens the door for more. Well, if you're still here, bless you. If you've unsubscribed, well, you won't hear this, but, you know, we had a good run together, didn't we? This is PCMC. Go bye-bye.